Hey, everybody, I'm Nick Layton.
And I'm Leah Bonema.
And we're the hosts of Were You Raised by Wolves?
Each week, we try to make the world a kinder, nicer place.
Well, that's the idea, at least.
I mean, we try.
Have you ever wondered what to do if you're ghosted?
Or what to do when a friend asks you to borrow money?
Or the proper way to eat Cheetos?
You know, the big questions.
So please find Were You Raised by Wolves wherever you listen.
Today's program is brought to you by the Dairy Farm Families of Wisconsin, the Wisconsin Milk Marketing Board. Did you know that today Wisconsin produces more than 600 varieties, types, and styles of American, international style, and original cheese that win more awards than any other state or country? To learn more, visit eatwisconsincheese.com.
Hi, this is Joe Campanelli, the host of In the Drink. You're listening to Heritage Radio Network, broadcasting live from Bushwick, Brooklyn. If you like this program, visit heritageradionetwork.org for thousands more.
Hello. This is Diane Stemple on Cutting the Curd on Heritage Radio Network. I am very pleased to have in the studio today Michael Tunick, author of The Science of Cheese, and also joining us is one of my favorite mentors in cheese, cheesemaker Peter Kandel. Welcome to both of you.
Thank you for inviting me.
Great to be here.
You're welcome. You're welcome. Michael, I want to let you know, and to let our listeners know, I was initially scared of your book. Because of the title, when it first arrived, the name, The Science of Cheese, plus the pictures of molecules inside the book, that was a little scary, and the scientific sounding words. So that's why I immediately panicked and invited the far more scientific Peter Kandel to join us. However, then I read the book, and I'm really impressed how The Science of Cheese integrates science, recipes, technical judge information, with an amazing array of stories, literary quotes, other interesting tidbits sprinkled throughout, and it teaches you things you never thought you could learn.
Yeah.
It's really,
that's the idea.
It's really well done. I must congratulate you. So let me ask you a few writerly questions when we get started. Then we'll dive into content. What's your background in terms of science and degrees and jobs? What do you do?
Well, I'm a research chemist, and I went to Drexel University in Philadelphia. I chose that one because they have a work-study program. You work 6 months, go to school for 6 months, and they assigned me a job at the United States Department of Agriculture outside of Philadelphia, mm-hmm. Eastern Regional Research Center. And there I was working on cocoa butter substitute. So that meant I got to analyze a lot of chocolate.
Ah.
When I graduated, I was hired full-time in another unit. And in that one, I was working on leather tannery waste, which isn't quite so delicious.
Mm-hmm.
And while I was doing that, I was attending Temple University on a part-time basis, going for a PhD in physical analytical chemistry.
Mm-hmm.
While I was there, an opening popped up in what is now the Dairy and Functional Foods Research Unit. They needed a physical analytical chemist,
mm-hmm.
so I was transferred over into there.
Hmm.
So I've been in that unit since 1984, and mm-hmm. most of the work that I've done has to do with cheese.
Okay. Now, when you first started, did you want to study food?
Yeah. Well, once I first started, which was back in 73, I thought mm-hmm. that food was a really fascinating topic because everybody eats,
right.
So therefore, you know, figuring out how food works seemed to be pretty interesting to me.
Mm-hmm.
And so I was kind of off of that during the time I was working with the hides and leather group, but then
mm-hmm.
I got back into it when I got in the dairy group. And
and you've been happily placed ever since.
That's right.
Cool.
That's right.
Cool. Now, what did you set out to write with this book? What was the initial idea, and did you pitch the idea, or did someone find you?
I did not pitch this idea.
Okay.
See, I'm active in the American Chemical Society.
Mm-hmm.
There's a division of agriculture and food chemistry that I was the chair of, and I'm the secretary of now.
Mm-hmm.
And there's also a speaker service, so I was able to go around to all these different local sections around the country and give a talk called Molecules to Mozzarella, the Chemistry of Cheese.
Ah!
And
Okay,
anyway,
so cheese was already something you liked speaking about.
Yeah. So in 2011, ACS started a webinar series, and they did one series on food chemistry, and so they asked me to give a webinar on cheese.
Our ACS, American Cheese Society.
No, the American Chemical Society, the other ACS.
Or the American Cancer Society is the other ACS.
It's not that one either. No, it's the American Chemical Society has 161,000 members.
Ah, so, much bigger than
our
little
bigger
group.
Than the cheese one.
Right.
But anyway, Oxford University Press handles the book publishing for that ACS.
Okay.
And they listened to the webinar, and they contacted me and asked if I'd be willing to write a book about the chemistry of cheese.
Uh-huh.
So I put a little proposal together and started figuring out what I wanted to say and how I wanted to say it. And they approved the proposal, and I started writing. So it took a couple of years.
Uh-huh.
And remember, I'm doing this, you know, as part of my official duties.
Oh, it is.
Yeah.
It is. Okay.
So
you don't have to only do it on weekends or at night.
Okay. No. We're also doing it, partly during the day, some of the work, which is also why I'm not getting royalties from the book, because I'm a government employee as part of
the
official duties.
Them.
So the royalties go to that Division of Agriculture and Food Chemistry.
Mm-hmm. With a book like this, are the royalties going to amount to that much?
Well, the last time I checked, they said that they sold over 2,000 copies. So you figure, that's something, and that's
right.
So that goes to help support to the programs in that division.
Mm-hmm. Now, so when you did the planning for the book, did you know you were going to include all the literary quotes, for example?
No. No, the webinar was purely scientific because I was speaking to chemists.
Right.
And once I got started, I figured to mix in, these other things, have some epigram at the start of each chapter and so forth, because I figured that general public would be interested in, how cheese relates to what other people have said about it and done about it and so forth. So
have to sell that idea?
No.
It's a phenomenal idea, and you have so many quotes that not only do you have them at every chapter head, you have them in some of the boxes, too.
Yeah.
It seemed like you had an excess of quotes.
Yeah.
And they're by people like T.S. Eliot, George Will, W.H. Auden, Flaubert, Cervantes. You are very well-rounded in your quoting.
Yeah. Well, thank
you. How did you find them? Was it an internet search? Did you have an assistant?
Partly. Well, I have some of the books at home. So there was one chapter where they were talking about somebody was afraid to eat cheese because there were bugs on it, which is crawling around it. And so somebody replies to him, well, don't worry about it because the bugs will eat the cheese and then you swallow the bugs and so you'll be having the cheese anyway. So that was from the Reed's novel, The Cloister and the Hearth, which I have at home. So it came from that. The Don Quixote, I have that at home.
But you
some of these others.
There are hundreds of quotes.
Yeah.
Came
from that or quotations books, things like that.
Right. For the non-scientist reading the book, they were so entertaining and they kept you entertained, laughing, like, where did he find this one?
And of course, I have a cousin, Allison, who's very fond of Charlie Chaplin because she's in the movie theater business. So I made sure to put in something about Chaplin's movie Shoulder Arms, where he tossed some Limburger into the enemy trench to flush them out. So I had some of the quotes with other things in mind.
Okay, very creative, touch. I was not expecting that.
Yeah.
So how long does it take to write a book like this, and what were your favorite parts to write?
Well, I started writing it in June of 2011, as soon as they told me to start writing a proposal.
Uh-huh.
And I was basically done by September of 2012, basically. Then I sent it out to a friend of mine in Ireland, that's Paul McSweeney, who wrote a blurb on the back cover. He checked it over, make sure that any of the mistakes I made got corrected and so forth. So that took until about December. And then it was sent to Oxford, and it took them almost 12 months between the time they got it until the time they got it into the stores.
Right, right. It always takes a while.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm.
So.
And are they pleased with it?
Yeah, they're pleased with it. They asked me to write another one on milk.
Oh.
So I don't know when that's going to happen, but.
The organizational aspect of it, you for people who haven't read the book yet, you separate it mostly into types of cheese.
Yeah.
But then what I think is phenomenal is that you include various pertinent topics within the cheese type chapters.
Yeah.
And you have your boxes, which you warn people they don't have to read.
Yeah.
But I read them.
Yeah.
But I liked, that was very smart of you to say you don't have to read the hard parts.
Yeah. That's right, and I'm not insulted if you don't, but I kept it in there in case you wanted to take a look at it.
Right.
But the way it was organized was that I would have a certain class of cheese, and then I would have a class of chemical compounds that are often found in that cheese. So that way, by going through the book, then we were able to hit all the classes of compounds that you find along with all the classes of cheese that there are.
Right. And it broke it up a little.
Yeah.
So you didn't have to read about too many compounds in a row, and you were in the mind frame of that particular type of cheese.
That's
did you notice that?
Yeah,
Peter?
I did. It was very well segmented. I thought I thought there was an approachable amount of scientific meat in there, and from the science side, it was fun to read too because you could dig a little deeper.
Yeah, you have to be careful not to make the chapters too long and, you know, things like that to make it kind of easy on the reader and, you know, a transition to the next chapter at the end of one and that kind of thing. So I had never written a book before. I've edited books, but I've never written one.
Right.
So this is all new to me. And
had you edited more chemistry books?
Yes.
Okay.
They've all been having to do with, you know, food chemistry. So I've done like about six of those.
Mm-hmm.
But this is the first time I've ever written one.
Right, right. And I'm sure it's a much different task.
Yeah, it's a different task completely.
And this one has quotes and fun stories in it too.
Which the other technical ones
probably
don't.
Didn't. Now, when you wrote it, who was the publisher expecting to be the first line of buyers for this book?
Probably, you know, food scientists and you know, people who work with cheese and who know more about the technical aspect, like Peter and you know, that kind of person first.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
But we've also been getting just you know, regular people who are interested in cheese who have been contacting me and just saying that they read it and liked it.
Yeah I think it can be pleasant and interesting for both audiences. I think I ran across it for the first time at our American Cheese Society meeting in the bookstore that they compile, and it scared me, but I took a picture of it for, you know, to pursue later.
Yeah, it's a kind of a little photogenic cover, kind of a black cover with chalk and a piece of cheese on there. So yellow piece of cheese. So when they first showed me a mock-up of the cover, I thought, well, that looks really interesting. That'll kind of stick out from all the others. And So that people have commented that it has. And
So that's and it has the molecule.
Yeah, and it has
the scary molecule. But it's cool enough so that you don't get too scared.
Yeah.
Anyway, so let's see. What are some of our issues to discuss? One thing I wanted that I really liked was in every cheese type, you have a very short, like, paragraph describing the recipe, kind of.
Yeah.
How it's made, the temperature, the type of milk. But you also said, which was one of the things that you wrote, that after so many simply written recipes, you say cheese or milk, it'll do as it damn well pleases.
Yeah, that's right. That's what happened. That's a saying about microorganisms in an experiment.
Oh, okay.
Given, you know, rigid control of temperature, humidity, pressure, and other factors, the organism will do as it damn well pleases.
Uh-huh.
So that's one thing about cheese making, is that you can keep everything as rigidly controlled as possible, and sometimes it doesn't come out the way you expect it to.
Right.
A lot of times that's because there might be something floating in the air that goes into the cheese vat.
Mm-hmm.
And other times, as I've mentioned in the book, the cheese may get a virus known as a phage or phage, depending on how you want to pronounce it. And so the bacteria gets sick, and suddenly you don't have cheese being made.
Mm-hmm.
So,
Not even doing its job.
Yeah, it's not doing its job. So that's why companies usually have more than one type of starter culture on hand, ready to go in case one of them gets sick. Then at least they can go with the other.
Now, if a phage gets sick, is it thrown out? Does it ever recover?
Yeah, well, they'll just start up a new culture. They can order it from the factory. They are places that make these starter cultures mm-hmm. of different kinds of cheese, and they would ship it at minus 80 degrees Celsius, and mm-hmm. which is way below minus 40 Fahrenheit, and then it would be thawed out, and they would be mm-hmm. grown up in milk in the plant. Mm-hmm. And from there, they could and make the cheese. But mm-hmm. in the meat, as I said, that they would usually have another culture standing by.
Right, right. It's wise to do that, to have more than one culture available. Yeah. Don't some people just rotate cultures back and forth?
I
remember.
Yeah, very commonly.
Montgomery cheddar.
Montgomery did one for every day of the week.
Yeah. Right.
You usually alternate different strains of the same style.
And why
it might
they
be
do
worth
that?
Discussing the science of the phage just to give people an idea of what. It's sort of like a virus that attacks bacteria specifically.
Yeah, that's right. Viruses can attack any living cells, and that includes bacteria, which mm-hmm. are a lot bigger than a virus. So in a bacteria can catch a virus, and
it'll have a cold.
Yeah.
Yeah, and nothing happens when you the acidification doesn't happen.
It just stops.
Work. Yeah. The bacteria goes to bed and won't do its work.
That's right.
Yeah. Yeah, then you have to change.
But that's not poisoning anything.
No.
It's just
you just have to clean up
well.
No, they
would just
after.
Dump out the vat and uh-huh. clean it out and start over with the new strain.
Mm-hmm. Do you have to have a more major cleanup after something like that happens?
It's enough to clean the way you normally do.
Okay.
And then shift your starter culture. A lot of times they'll have something like MM100, there's two different strains of a single strain of bacteria that mm-hmm. that if you alternate over the course of time, phage doesn't have a chance to get a foothold in your room.
Oh, is it sort of like a drug-resistant antibiotics? Like the phage gets too smart?
Similar. Similar, yeah.
There are other
starter cultures that are blends of uh-huh. a bunch of different acidifiers.
And they'll be stronger fighting a phage.
You just have to remember that cheese plants are very clean places, because if you have the starter culture bacteria growing, you can also have pathogenic bacteria growing if they get in there.
Mm-hmm.
So you want to make sure that everything is scrupulously clean mm-hmm. at all times. So that's why they use the stainless steel, and they mm-hmm. clean everything out as best they can all the time.
Mm-hmm. Okay.
So that you don't get the outbreaks of a foodborne illness.
Right, right. I want to talk about that later, but first I want to talk about something that reminds me of. Could you tell the story in the book about the Liederkranz?
Yeah. Now, that is a type of cheese that's somewhat similar to Limburger. It was developed in upstate New York. The word Liederkranz means wreath of song. It was named after a singing society in New York. And that one, they moved a factory to a place
in Ohio.
Yeah, New Ulm, Ohio. And they brought the starter culture, and they tried to start making the cheese, but didn't come out right.
Mm-hmm.
And
it wasn't tasty enough,
no,
right?
No. Turns out that you also had bacteria living on the wooden walls and the racks mm-hmm. of the old cheese plant. So they scraped the bacteria and mold and everything off of the old plant and brought it into the new plant and let that go in the air, and that worked.
And that fixed their cheese.
Yes. And there's no way that happens nowadays.
But I want you to apply that to the ruckus that was going on last summer when the FDA said no wood shells.
Yeah. They were interpreting the rule to mean that you can only have something like a non-porous stainless steel shelf to work on.
Mm-hmm.
And, well, the cheese industry was in an uproar because you're not going to get, you know, pathogenic bacteria by aging cheese on a shelf that, you know, you're keeping clean all the time.
Mm-hmm.
So after a few days, they realized they made a mistake and changed their minds and said, okay, you can use those wooden shelves.
Uh-huh. That was a big brouhaha for ACS, American Cheese Society.
Yeah.
It happened right before our meeting, and the FDA came to our meeting. Now, are you an arm of the FDA?
No. FDA is part of the Department of Health and Human Services.
Okay.
It's an agency there. I work for the Agriculture Research Service, which is an agency of the U.S. Department of Agriculture. So it's a different department, and we do different things.
Mm-hmm.
So FDA is regulatory, and Agriculture Research Service is research. It's not regulatory, so we don't go inspecting
things. Do you overlap at meetings?
Yeah, we do have, you know, FDA and ARS mm-hmm. people, you know, attending in the same meetings and so forth.
Mm-hmm.
But, yeah, we have it, but we just have different jobs.
Okay. Okay. Just wondering. Well, I think it's time for our break. This is Diane Stemple with Michael Tunick and Peter Kindel on Cutting the Curd, and we'll be back in a little bit.
The Dairy Farm Families of Wisconsin and the Wisconsin Milk Marketing Board are proud to underwrite Cutting the Curd on heritageradionetwork.org. Wisconsin cheeses have an illustrious heritage of more than 170 years of quality and craftsmanship. During this long and rich history, the art and science of cheesemaking have been captured in time-honored traditions that produce cheese varieties of unsurpassed excellence. Today, Wisconsin produces more than 600 varieties, types, and styles of American, international style, and original cheeses that win more awards than any other state or country. To learn more, visit www.eatwisconsincheese.com.
Hi, we're back on Cutting the Curd. Talking to Michael Tunick about his book, The Science of Cheese. One of the things that I found very interesting in the book that I did not realize was news to me is that you say lots of research has been done on cheese.
Yes, a whole lot of research has been done on cheese and on milk and on other dairy products too.
Uh-huh. Why so much on cheese?
Well, for one thing, it's because a lot of people like it.
Uh-huh.
There's been a lot of flavor chemistry on cheese. There's also been a lot of texture chemistry done mm-hmm. on cheese. There's a branch of science known as rheology, which is the study of flow and deformation of matter.
Mm-hmm.
So I do a lot of rheological work in which do things like squeezing a piece of cheese and seeing how much hardness it has and how much it springs back and how cohesive
mm-hmm.
it is.
Mm-hmm.
And those are things that cheesemakers have to keep in mind if they want to have reproducible cheese because, mm-hmm. you know, it isn't just flavor, it's also texture. So you have a lot of work on both areas in cheese. And, of course, with the more cheese varieties you have and the more species of animal that are used to make the cheese, then you're going to have a whole lot of different things to look at.
More and more permutations and combinations.
Yeah.
I was a aesthetic judge at the American Cheese Society meeting in Louisville years ago, and my technical judge was much more interested in the texture and the feel of cheese.
Yeah.
And so when I read about your two, rheology and mm-hmm. tribology?
Yeah, tribology.
Tribology.
Which is the taste and so forth. So, yeah,
that
how it
seemed
feels
like
in the mouth.
Those are the sciences of chewing and swallowing and stuff like that.
Yeah, that's right.
Yeah. Your description of chewing in the book is kind of yucky.
Yeah. Well, that's...
It's like you're putting boulders in your mouth and tossing them about and smushing them and tearing them and...
Yeah, it's got to clear and so forth, but, you know, that's how it has to feel a certain way. And, of course, by doing that, you also release the flavor.
Right,
so that goes in your nose, and there are instruments for measuring that. And I have a picture of a friend of mine, Devin Peterson, University of Minnesota, with a thing up his nose as he's smelling the cheese and trying to figure out what the compounds smell like as they're coming out and this instrument.
Are there any people who just are rheologists and only do that kind of research?
Well, they're physical chemists like me. So, I mean, I do rheology, but I also do thermal analysis mm-hmm. and electron microscopy to see mm-hmm. how it looks. So, you know, we do other things, too. It isn't mm-hmm. – I don't just do rheology.
So it's just like a small branch.
Yeah, it's just a part of the things that we do, yeah.
Okay, amazing. What did you think about the research aspects?
It always astounds me as to how much each little bit of cheese, each little, micro unit of cheese has been picked apart. And just looking in the credits at the back of the book – I love going into the just database of all of the papers that are cited in there.
Yeah, I was shocked. And you say cheddar has been researched more than
the most.
Than, the most.
Because
and
it's basically the most popular.
Oh, it's popular, yeah. And because it's big?
Yeah. Yeah, that too.
Actually physically big?
Yeah, well, partly because of that, and it's so commonly available. I mean, there are some cheeses that are not so commonly available, so obviously you're not going to get much research on it. But, with cheddar, you got a lot of research. Mozzarella also, because it's more popular than cheddar in the United States at this point.
Okay.
And then you have all the other varieties, which people are working on, so...
Now, how do you measure popularity? Pounds sold?
Yeah. The United States Department of Agriculture has an agricultural marketing service. Mm-hmm. And so one thing that they do, they measure the amount of cheese that's sold according to what's reported to them by cheese plants.
Mm-hmm.
So we now know that mozzarella is about 34% of all the cheese that's manufactured in the United States. And
it's past cheddar?
Yeah, cheddar's about 31 at this point.
That's impressive because you don't eat as much mozzarella at a time, I
you
think.
You eat pizza.
Yes, but
we
eat pizza.
Yeah, that's
it goes
true.
Through pizza.
Right,
yes.
Right.
Children
so it's
eat
more...
string cheese. And so between those two, it's really shot up from where it used to be, which is not as popular before.
Oh, okay. Peter, you had a question about mozzarella.
Oh, it's more of a technical... Yeah. A technical question, because I do a lot of cheese classes and I teach mozzarella, and it took me literally, I've made cheese for 20 years and I flailed at mozzarella for the first 16 of them.
Wow.
I think, a lot of it was that I was working at goat dairies.
Oh.
And the goat milk just doesn't work as well as the cow.
Yeah.
And
no,
once
doesn't.
I got to cow's milk, I started making mozzarella and it was still very rubbery and it drove me crazy. Then I realized they're using a lot more citric acid and vinegar instead of letting bacteria, approaching it as a cheesemaker was always my downfall, is I let the bacteria use up all the lactose and turn it into something very rubbery and acidic, and it didn't taste great.
You mean you had to approach it more like a cook or a chef?
Yeah, it was a little more of a technology of cheese where you add citric acid instead of letting the bacteria eat the sugar.
Okay.
And a lot of that creates the final sweetness in it as opposed to a very acidic, rubbery thing. But there's a point that you reach in the stretchability. You see it in cheddar as well. It's about between 5.4 and 5.2 pH, where it relaxes. Mm-hmm. And I always wonder what that relaxation and that stretch is. Is it the calcium starting to go aqueous in it?
That's right.
Okay.
Yeah, there's different pH levels where different things happen. At pH 6, you have one thing going, then you get like 5.2 to 5.4, then the calcium allows it to stretch. If you go down much lower into the 4s, then goes back again. So you go from solid to rubbery to solid again, and so forth. So there's a lot having to do with the pH in there. One problem that you might have had with the goat mozzarella is because there's a particular kind of casein called alpha S1, which is big in cow milk, and it provides the structure for the protein matrix in there. But goat's milk has little of it. So if you're trying to make goat's milk mozzarella or any other product from goat's milk, you're not going to have such a strong cheese. And so that may be why the mozzarella wasn't going to work out very well.
Right.
That reminds me of some other very cool pages in your book where you list potential problems in cheese and ways to fix it.
Yeah.
Which I've been involved in conversations between cheesemakers and have just been sort of spacing out on the side, and your book really shows what they're talking about.
Yeah.
It's phenomenal that it can be on a page in a book, though I think you pointed out that it's not always so easy to fix.
The bacteria will do what it damn well pleases. I think what it boils down to is you can sort of hedge your bets, and as a winemaker pointed out to me, I have it easy because I have 5 or 6 vintages per week. And he gets one a year. And so when you're making something every day, you have to be a really good observer and a really good note taker to evolve the cheese into something that behaves the way you want it to.
Right, yeah. And then there's some intangibles that you're not really aware of, like the weather or the mood of the cow or who knows.
The stage of lactation and what they're eating, all that kind of thing goes into it also. Cheese and wine and beer are three fermented foods that you're dealing with microorganisms, so you can have a lot of variation in there.
I thought it was interesting too that the book talked about that there's not as much science yet that's gone into pairing research. I guess one of my side notes was to ask you, are we all nuts about this? Like, are we being silly trying to figure out pairings?
No, I mean, you figure that if the same class of compound is found in cheese and some other food, then those two foods might go together. And so that isn't really crazy. Now, there may not be much to it, or there may be something else having to do with it, but there's nothing wrong with trying to do this. It's like a hobby.
Right.
You're trying to figure, well, this goes with that, but it doesn't seem to, this cheese doesn't go with chocolate, but it does go with figs and walnuts.
Right.
Kind of thing.
Right.
And what's the harm in trying?
Yeah.
Right. You're only eating cheese.
Yeah, that's
and
right.
And drinking wine or beer.
I was wondering, though, if sometimes, is it because everyone's palates are different? And isn't there a whole science of sensory, science of palate and taste?
Yeah, there's like 10% of the population are super tasters, and they can taste a lot of things.
But that's not good to be a super taster, right?
Well, if you're really into things like wine vintages and fine cheeses, it's a really good thing.
Oh, I thought it was like too much taste.
Well, that depends. I'm not a super taster by any means, so I wouldn't know for sure. But then you have like another 10% who can't taste much of anything, and then you have everybody else in between.
Right. But people, you don't know. It's very difficult to I mean, this is more in the psychology department. If I taste something and you taste something, how do we communicate that it tastes the same?
It might not taste the same to the same person and
to
different people.
Right.
That's why, for one thing, that instrument that you inhale to see what it smells like, you have a couple people doing it, and they'll come up with two different answers on a lot of different things.
Right.
It's just what a person's impression is.
Mm-hmm. And not being, not being able to scale it the same.
Yeah, that's one thing you do have to do, like with the taste panels and all, which I've involved in at work, is that we have a scale, and you go from, it actually goes from 1 to 7 usually, to see how intense something is. And somebody can be sensitive to salt and rate something a 5, and another person is not so sensitive, rated a 2.
Right. Could you both weigh in on, I want to talk a little bit about safety and pathogens. There's also been another discussion with the FDA about non-toxic listeria and what the levels should be in cheese and how impossible they set the levels. Could you talk a little bit about that?
Well, I know about toxic listeria because we've worked on it. And the problem with listeria is that not very many people get listeriosis, but about 20% of the people who do get it die.
Right.
So that's a really important one. Yeah, E. coli is another one that's found in there, but not a whole lot of people die from that. I wouldn't want to have any kind of listeria inside of my product, whether they call it non-toxic or not, because in case it might mutate.
It's usually considered an indicator species. If listeria is in something, then it's contaminated. So it just indicates that there could be something in there.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
But aren't the numbers that are currently allowed in this country very different from what is usually allowed in Europe?
Yes. Mm-hmm. Yeah, and I remember in France in 1999, I guess we were in the Auvergne, they were going crazy about the zero tolerance policy of listeria, saying it's just incomprehensible from a cheesemaker standpoint. Mm-hmm. And for good or bad, if you find it. And we do a lot of environmental testing, or we did a lot of environmental testing for listeria in the cheese house. And I mean, even the testing is very sort of questionable these days. And it picks up both live or dead listeria. So you have to literally kill it and then get rid of it. And then you don't get a positive.
Okay.
So it's a difficult thing.
Okay.
But cleanliness is key.
Mm-hmm. I wanted to ask you if you knew about Stitchleton, because you have a interesting thing about the English cheeses and mm-hmm. how many of them are now pasteurized.
Yeah, they're worried a bit about foodborne bacteria mm-hmm. over there too, obviously. So you do get some it's pasteurization, and there are the cheeses that get shipped to the United States a lot of times are pasteurized too.
Right.
And,
so have you had or seen Stitchleton, which is a newer Stilton?
That one I haven't seen yet.
Oh, okay.
How new is it? Because
it's not that new. Joe Schneider for Neil's Yard has been making it for a couple of years.
Maybe five by now,
It's sold at, fancier cheese shops alongside of Stilton. Okay. And it's called Stitchleton, and it's a bit creamier, I'd say.
It is. A lot more giving texture.
Yeah.
I always taste them side by side with people just to give them the sense of what it was and what it used to be.
Right, right, right.
It is a brand new thing.
Yeah, well, regular Stilton's one of my favorites. I'm going to have to give that one a try.
Okay, you're going to have to try Stitchleton then. I'm sure you're from Philadelphia. I'm sure DeBruno's has it.
Yeah, they probably would.
Because they're Neil's Yard Dairy fans.
Mm-hmm.
Anyway, so, well, our time is up. I want to thank both Michael Tunick and Peter Kandel, and we loved reading The Science of Cheese for resolute non-scientists such as myself. This book taught me a lot, and thank you, Peter, for joining us, and I'll be back next month on Cutting the Curd. Okay. Thanks.
Thank you.
Thanks for listening to this program on heritageradionetwork.org. You can find all of our archived programs on our website or as podcasts in the iTunes Store by searching Heritage Radio Network. You can like us on Facebook and follow us on Twitter at @heritage_radio. You can email us with questions anytime at info@heritageradionetwork.org. Heritage Radio Network is a 501c3 nonprofit. To donate and become a member, visit our website today. Thanks for listening.
Hi, listeners. We want to tell you about a podcast we're really digging. It's called Christopher Kimball's Milk Street Radio. Every week, they travel the world to find the most fascinating stories about food, including children who harvest cod tongues after school in Norway and a detective who tracks down food thieves. And on Milk Street Radio, you can always find the unexpected. The comedian who ranks apples using an elaborate 100-point system, the secret history of grocery stores, and how to eat your way through Italy. They also interview the most beloved names in food like Jacques Pepin, Sola Alweli, Jose Andres, Jet Tila, Ina Garten, Nigella Lawson, and Padma Lakshmi. Plus, co-hosts Christopher Kimball and Sarah Moulton do live calls with listeners and answer their questions about ingredients, techniques, and culinary mysteries, like why roasting a leg of lamb made one caller's oven explode. Ever wonder why your bread won't rise or your souffle falls flat? Chris and Sarah have the answers. You'll also hear from a rotating cast of contributors, including Kenji Lopez-Alt, Cheryl Day, Dan Pashman from The Sporkful, and Alex Inouz, a French guy cooking from YouTube. Take a listen at 177milkstreet.com/radio or just search your podcast app for Milk Street Radio.